This week on Your Western Context, Google is banning political ads ahead of the fall election. John Horgan wants us to stop whining about softwood lumber, and an anti-energy advocate is now part of Alberta's energy regulator. Also, Trudeau's cabinet experiences another resignation. This is Western Context, episode 109, recorded Saturday, March 9th, 2019, Experiencing Truth. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself sitting in again, once as per usual.
Good to be back again. Lots of things going on that have been in the media this week and have also not been in the media this week. A lot of things have flown under the radar as the media in particular is continuing to talk about one story in particular, and lots of others flying under the radar, which is why we're here to highlight all those instances where the media does not.
Indeed, and if you're joining us for the first time, that's what we do here on the show. We highlight everything, whether it be from an independent blog all the way up to the big giants such as the National Post and CBC, and what we hope to do throughout this entire process is provide you, the listeners, with all the information and context necessary to put yourselves on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin this week with a Canada story that flew under the radar quite significantly, because you don't get any bigger than this on the internet. And the headline with this is that Google is to ban political ads ahead of federal election, citing new transparency rules. So Google has taken the extraordinary step of banning political advertising on its ad platform ahead of the election. And anybody who uses the internet probably can't go more than 5 minutes without seeing a Google ad on the internet. You might not even realize it sometimes when you are seeing those this day and age. Now, this is ultimately the result of a Bill C-76, which was passed this past September, and this would require ad companies, pretty much anybody who actually runs an ad on the internet, to keep a registry of all political and partisan ads that they directly or indirectly publish. And that's the key word right there. Now, speaking for Google, Colin McKay, who is Google Canada's head of public policy and government relations, called this decision painful, ultimately saying that we've come to the decision that the best way for Google to comply with the Elections Act in the 2019 election cycle is actually to stop accepting election ads as defined in the legislation. And these requirements would come into effect on June 30th of the election year, as in just a few months from now. Now, Google is pulling out of the ad business for election campaigns because it is not easy to detect ads of a partisan nature if they don't mention a candidate or a political party name. Because let's face it, we have known for many years that ads have been talking about ideas and ideologies and policies one way or the other here. It's not always, let's go vote for John Appleseed, the candidate from your riding directly to the south of you. It's always going to be potentially also about an idea or an idea that an opponent is running that they may not like. And it is not easy for Google to track down these advertisements. And he said that the reason this is a challenge for us is that the definition is extremely broad. Now, Google also spoke to a Senate committee this past November on this issue, and they even noted back then that it would be extremely difficult to comply with the new regulations that have been put in place with Bill C-76. Now, the way that ad sales work online is that every user on the internet has a profile effectively associated with them that's built based on the websites that you go to and the ads that you click on successfully when you're browsing the internet. And there is no specific targeting of an advertisement to a specific user. Everything is done automated, and in most cases, this happens in a fraction of a second. So when you visit a web page, the page will load and there will be a box on the page for an advertisement. And these can come through Google, or they can even come through other advertising sources. But Google is definitely the biggest one on the internet today. That is how they make all their money. And throughout this advertising process, the user is then directed to an advertising exchange. And then the folks who are running the web page, the publisher, have an account with Google, and then that account participates in an immediate auction of that ad space, and then an ad is chosen that is acceptable to that user, and then the ad is finally displayed on the screen that the user is viewing that web page on. And this is what makes this so difficult, in that this is an entirely automated process, and Google has no way of filtering out the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of ads that run on their AdSense platform. And if Google wanted to create such a registry, they could potentially do that, but just the amount of time and effort that they would need to put into creating such a registry is something that, at the end of the entire fact, might not even work, because as we mentioned here, this advertising system is automated. So even if Google knew how many ads were of a partisan nature that were destined to be shown in Canada, not necessarily just related to a specific political party or a candidate, there would be no way to know where these ads are shown or who they are shown to. And Google has just decided that, you know, this is a huge ask for us to do, and we really can't even keep up with this, because this falls under the indirect side of this provision inside Bill C-76. And, you know, with this, there are potentially dozens or hundreds of different advertising campaigns going on for this, and you would effectively need a registry for each of these, and Google would then need to report that to the Canadian officials in this case. And this is partly why Google has decided in order that they need to step down with this, is because there is no way to be 100% certain. There is no way of knowing whether or not the ads that are being shown are of a political partisan nature. And even if they are, there's no way of knowing if they have been registered with the registry that the federal government mandates. So with that being said, Google is putting themselves out in the forefront of potentially facing fines if some of these ads were to sneak through that were not registered. And as a huge company that likes to deal within absolutes and likes certainty, they made the decision then to step away from this because they don't want to risk fines. Now, with that being said, YouTube will also be exempt in this, in that YouTube will function as normal. And anybody who has seen YouTube will know that in some cases, YouTube recommendations of recommended videos from various sources that might be related to videos you've watched in the past can actually be sometimes more powerful than advertisements themselves. And, of course, we can't also forget Facebook and Twitter, because those are ad publishers as well. And, of course, the media organizations within Canada. And this includes newspapers, broadcasters, and pretty much any media organization that has an app also needs to keep a registry of partisan advertisements in the minor sense that is defined in Bill C-76 that they're running as well. Now, John Hines, who is the CEO of News Media Canada, said that even publishers needing to keep a directory of all their ads that appear on their site is asking a question of even if the publishers can comply on this, because as we mentioned in the Google story, if you are the National Post and you're using Google as your way of advertising, there's no way of knowing which ads the Google service will show, and this is partially why Google is pulling out. And for smaller publications that run their own ads, they're going to need to be watching this as well. So this is adding in a huge amount of gray area for practically anyone who publishes anything on the internet in this day and age. Now, since we're on the topic of Bill C-76, we should also mention that Bill C-76 does also prevent a third party from using funds if the source of these funds is a foreign entity. And you might be wondering why that's important. Well, in the 2015 race, the Tides Foundation in the United States funneled money to groups in Canada, including Lead Now, to the tune of $1.5 million, when in the 2015 election, third-party spending in that race totaled in coming in at around $6 million. So 1.5 out of 6 is pretty big, and that money came from an American company. So that hole has also been plugged with Bill C-76. So while we have lots of other news this week, it's quite clear that this one did fly under the radar because Google bowing out of the advertising scene here in Canada for the election period when it comes to partisan-related ads is definitely a big story. But if the media also looked at Bill 76 as we did in our preparation for this, we would have seen that this hole that brought a lot of foreign money into Canada in the 2015 race has also been plugged.
Yeah, so in a way, there's two different sides to this story here. And one, of course, is that their political parties are going to find it a lot harder to try and get their messaging out there. And they're going to have to rely more on non-traditional means of advertising, such as through YouTube, through emails, through different websites, news, and of course, the traditional ones, such as print media and TV. Thankfully, we won't be seeing too much advertising through Google on this if they do decide to just pull out completely on this issue. But it's going to change how parties are going to try and get their messaging out there. And we all know that they will definitely try and do that, especially as we head closer and closer into an election campaign here in the fall.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a statement that was actually emailed to the federal government, emailed from the federal government. And this was from Democratic Institution Minister Karina Gold's office. And she said Google's decision to opt out of political advertising during the regulated period appears to have been made for business reasons and does not reflect on the quality of our laws. But, you know, this is also what happens at the end of the day when you have politicians making laws and they don't understand how Google and how the advertising online business works, in that you can't just have a huge blacklist of ads, or you can't automatically have Google assume that they know every ad that is going to be run on their platform. And, you know, we here at Western Context like to think in terms of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, both for individuals and for folks who want to publish on ad platforms. But at the end of the day, any bill that drives a business as big as Google away from serving in Canada needs to have some questions shone upon it.
Yeah, exactly. Because at the end of the day, it all comes down to signals, as we've talked about many times before, and signals pertaining to whether a business culture is friendly enough for a company to do business in Canada. And this is sending the signal that they're wanting to make it much more difficult for Google to be able to operate in Canada. And that's something that we don't want to have happen, as all of that different ad revenue, all of the jobs that come through Google Canada, we certainly don't want to lose out on that. And as we move further and further into the 21st century, we don't want to be left behind in the technological aspect as well.
Yeah. And I mean, we also need to look and realize and say, ask the government, is that what exactly is a political and partisan ad? I mean, if Western Context decided to take an ad out, would we qualify under that umbrella, and would we not be able to serve in that time period? And that's a question that also needs to be asked as well, because when it comes down to it, if they are blocking businesses and organizations from within Canada from advertising on Google for this period, that is potentially also hurting those businesses down the line as well. So it's not really well thought out on the part of the government. But
that's for sure.
All right, what do we got for BC this week?
So it's been a fairly quiet week for news in BC this week, as the media, local or otherwise, gets caught up in the continuing fallout of the Trudeau-SNC corruption scandal, which we will be talking about a little bit later. Anything that the BC provincial government is doing seems to be flying under the radar. The major news of the week is that former Supreme Court of Canada Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin was approved by all three parties in the legislature to investigate the legislature spending scandal. According to the BC legislature press release, McLaughlin will determine, quote, whether Craig James, who was the clerk of the Legislative Assembly, or Gary Lenz, sergeant-at-arms, engaged in misconduct in the course of their employment as permanent officers of the Legislative Assembly, as outlined in reports by Speaker Daryl Plakis that have been publicly released by the Legislative Assembly Management Committee. So that's a pretty big deal. If anyone can get to the bottom of this mess, it's probably McLaughlin. Now, the other story to come out of BC also flew in under the radar, but longtime BC residents will recognize it as a story that has been present for many decades. It is, of course, the never-ending debate over softwood lumber exports and the crippling tariffs that the U.S. continues to land on lumber exports, mainly through BC. Though one of BC's biggest industries and one of the greatest sources of wealth for our province, the NDP government does not seem to be willing to go to bat for the forestry industry to ensure that we're getting fair value for our exports. Now, last week, the topic of softwood lumber came up in the legislature. Premier John Horgan came under increased scrutiny from the official opposition about the softwood lumber dispute after telling Merritt MLA Jackie Taggart to, quote, stop whining about it. Now, Horgan was quick to respond that the negotiations between the two countries had fallen apart and that the softwood lumber issue was now being resolved in the courts. The premier then touted the government's work to revitalize the BC forest industry, calling for Taggart to get on board with it rather than whining about it. Now, Taggart had this to say about the issue. Quote, there are 140 forestry-dependent communities in our province that are suffering without a softwood lumber deal. I have had constituents come into my office literally in tears because of rolling layoffs at the local mill. I am appalled at the premier of this province would call MLAs whiners during question period today for putting pressure on the government to act. The premier said nearly 2 years ago that he would be directly involved in negotiations, but we haven't seen or heard anything since. To have the premier suggest that it would be inappropriate for us to call them out to account on promises they made 2 years ago, it to me is a little bit more than disappointing. He has been in the States a number of times. He should be bringing this up every time he's there. It should be a top priority. Now, forestry critic John Rustad agreed with this. He said, quote, British Columbia is responsible for 50% of all softwood lumber exports to the United States. Horgan should be on the forefront of Canadian efforts to resolve this dispute. Now, one underlying issue in this dispute is the difference in land ownership between the two countries. In the U.S., about 90% of forest land is owned and managed by private entities, whereas in Canada, about 90% is managed by provincial governments on behalf of the public. Another issue with this is leading to the continuation of this dispute is that the U.S. lumber industry has been successful since the mid-1980s in having its government impose tariffs on Canadian lumber, even after Canada demonstrated in international appeals that the tariffs were unfounded. Now, currently, with no deal in place between Canada and the U.S. on the issue, America is free to implement duties on the lumber being imported from Canada, to whatever percentage they decide. Now, two of these duties are the countervailing and the anti-dumping duties. The BC government describes the duties as follows. Countervailing is where the U.S. government has argued that the duty is required to offset unfair subsidies that the Canadian and provincial governments allegedly provide to lumber companies. And the anti-dumping duty is being argued by the U.S. as required to offset unfair selling practices by Canadian lumber companies that are allegedly selling lumber into the U.S. at a price below their costs or sales value in Canada. Now, prices for lumber were strong through 2018, but have experienced a downturn in recent months. Prices of the benchmark softwood lumber commodity Western spruce pine fir was measured at U.S. $402 MFBM, which is a measurement used to measure lumber, which is 1,000 board feet, one board foot being 1 foot long by 1 foot wide by 1 inch thick wood. Now, this week, that price is down 4.7% compared to last week, and to 1 month ago is down 26% from the same time in 2018, when it was $540 MFBM. Now, strong housing markets in the U.S. as well as in Canada have boosted sales of lumber, but as we've seen in Vancouver and Toronto, the housing bubble will crash eventually, leading to a loss of revenue in the forestry industry as well as jobs in small communities in BC that depend on natural resource work to survive. Now, due to the downturn this year in prices, many sawmills in Canada, particularly in BC, have been curtailing operations or closing for extended periods of time to save costs. Caribou Chilcotin MLA Donna Barnett had this to say on the issue. Premier Horgan held a joint news conference with Washington State Governor Inslee just weeks ago and never even raised the topic of softwood lumber. We have a premier who appears in lots of photo ops but seems afraid to act on behalf of the forestry industry. Now, in that, she was referring to Horgan meeting Washington State Governor Inslee just a few weeks ago, where he actually handed the governor a check for $600,000, in essence, to study a rail link between Seattle and Surrey. This happened the day after a Buy American executive order from the White House made it impossible for Canadian companies to even contribute to that study or the construction project in the extremely unlikely event it is ever built. Now, New Brunswick PC Premier Blaine Higgs, who was elected just last fall, has already met with counterparts on the East Coast in Washington to try and ease tariffs on the New Brunswick forestry industry. He was meeting with New England governors just last week, who were sympathetic and promised to try and find a way forward. So if Atlantic Canada's newest premier is attempting to make inroads with the U.S. on this issue, it begs the question, why isn't Horgan? And why is the media not talking about it?
And, you know, when it comes down to it, prior to the renegotiation of NAFTA, the biggest and perhaps the most high-profile trade dispute that we had in the mid-2000s with the United States was softwood lumber. The deal expired, I believe it was in 2015, and there really has been no efforts made by the federal government here in Canada to renew it or find a new deal, because it is up to the federal government to pursue treaties and trade deals with foreign countries, and that's what the U.S. is in this case. And softwood lumber was a huge deal back in 2005, 2006, so much so that it became an election issue. But here, it almost seems as though we have the agreement of USMCA soon to be ratified, and the media and most of the other people covering BC and Washington State and even Canada US trade are just happy to move on with USMCA being dealt with. But in reality, softwood is a much bigger issue, and that can also lead to further discussions on the existing steel and aluminum tariffs that are in place that might be coming off soon. If U.S.'s negotiations with China are any indication on that. So as with all things economic, all these things are linked together. And while the media sees the USMCA as a positive, there are still these very big question marks that are left to linger, even though USMCA has a deal reached on it. The softwood issue is one that is incredibly local to BC and can do a great deal of harm to the BC economy if not dealt with.
Yeah, that's true. And it seems like the softwood lumber dispute is something that not only are Canadian politicians not willing to bring up with the U.S., the U.S. aren't even aware of them. A lot of officials in Washington over the business meetings that Blaine Higgs had gone to said they weren't even aware that there was an issue at all on softwood lumber, and that a lot of them didn't see that there was any problem with it, which begs the question as to why it wasn't even brought up with the USMCA trade negotiations. And the fact that there was such a difficult deal to make on USMCA to begin with, that it makes you wonder what exactly they were negotiating for when they were doing those at the time.
Yeah, Chrystia Freeland could have carried on those discussions, but we all know it was a very draining experience negotiating with the U.S. as it would be. So,
Exactly.
Well, we'll move on to our firing line here in just a bit after Alberta. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment and talk about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And you can support the podcast there. So for $2 a month or the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. Or if you want to go up to $5 a month for the price of a sandwich, you continue to help us do that. And you can have your name read out on the podcast if you so desire. And for $10 a month, you can become an insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And in case you're wondering what we're doing with this, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the state of the news and provide our opinion on where affairs might be headed next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month and your questions. You can find out more about this at patreon.com/westerncontext. And we also do have an option to make a one-time PayPal contribution. You can do this by visiting westerncontext.ca/support, where you can find the link to make that PayPal contribution and all this and more on supporting this podcast. All right, so we're going to head on into Alberta right now, and you know, there's been lots of news this week, jobs reports, and talk about the economy, what the economy is actually doing. We talked about some of those last week. More analysis was done this week on that, and suffice to say, the picture isn't good. There's also lots of campaigning that's been going on, as we have been saying since effectively the first week of this year. It is election season in Alberta, but the campaign has not been called yet. So we're going to actually talk about something that the government did that wasn't related to the election campaign, but the media skipped over in a pretty interesting way. Now, with this, there's a body in Alberta called the Alberta Energy Regulator. And the headline here is NDP government appoints an enemy to the Alberta Energy Regulator. So what exactly is this? Well, the NDP government appointed Ed Whittingham to this energy regulator. And in case you've never heard this name, and it's a pretty obscure person, we never heard of him before before this story, but it did turn out that he was standing next to Premier Rachel Notley at the podium when she announced her carbon tax way back in 2016. Now, Whittingham is the former executive director of the Pembina Institute, which you may have heard of, from 2011 to 2017. Now, the Pembina Institute is a think tank that is working to reduce the negative impacts of fossil fuels while supporting Canada's transition to an energy system that is clean and safe. And this is directly from their website. So this is what the organization that describes themselves as. There is definitely zero media sensationalism in that. It's right from the Pembina Institute website. Now, Whittingham will make $76,500 per year, with an additional $750 per day each day that he participates in meetings with the Alberta Energy Regulator. So you're probably wondering now, what does the Alberta Energy Regulator do? Well, it regulates the life cycle of oil sands, natural gas, and coal projects in Alberta, effectively deciding if they can come to fruition or not. And this includes everything, including oil wells, pipelines, gas facilities, oil sands mines, in-situ projects, upgraders, coal mines, and coal processing plants, just to name a few things. Now, according to Vivian Krause, who we have tweeted before on our social media pages at Western Context, she is a Vancouver-based researcher that has been following the flow of money into anti-Alberta oil groups recently. Now, the Pembina Institute, according to her research, accepted $8 million in foreign funding from U.S. foundations, including the Tides Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, and the Oak Foundation, all of which operate under the guise of the Tar Sands Campaign, which was defined in the mid-2000s, that ultimately had the aim of landlocking Alberta's oil. Now, Whittingham was also involved in pushing the Trudeau government and the National Energy Board to have the Energy East consultations, the pipeline that would have carried Alberta oil east through Quebec and to the East Coast, to have these consultations include emissions from the consumers of the end oil products, whether they be gasoline or plastics, and effectively take all of these ramifications of these products into ultimately the cost of building the project and not just the construction of the pipeline itself. And that is effectively what killed Energy East, if you recall back from our discussions last year on this on the podcast. Now, Post Media asked for an interview with Ed Whittingham, but the Alberta Energy Regulator did not approve the interview. They would not let him speak. And, you know, if you look at what's been happening here, this is an appointment that was made by the provincial government, the provincial NDP government here, and this is a complete 180 U-turn from what this government has been championing, and this really wasn't talked about in the media. We all know that this government has been championing the Trans Mountain Pipeline. If you watch TV, if you go on the internet, you've seen Trans Mountain Pipeline ads. The premier herself went to Ottawa to speak to the Senate about ensuring that the pipeline would get built. And the premier is even out there campaigning on pipelines and getting them built. But on the other hand, here we have Ed Whittingham being hired for the Alberta Energy Regulator, which is an action of ultimately having the actions of this government speak louder than the words that they are championing through their ads and through what the premier herself is actually saying. Now, before we wrap this up, it's worth noting that the Rebel first ran with the story on February 22nd, and the media is now finally covering it after it was brought forward. And this is something that we have, of course, noticed in the past, is that it seems as though if the Rebel gets to a story first, the media will go out of their way not to cover it. But the very fact we are in an election cycle, unofficially, shows that the media should definitely have been covering this appointment.
Exactly. Considering that this gentleman was the executive director of an institute that is trying to work against energy projects in Alberta, and the fact that now he is in charge of the keys, unlocking all of those projects that can be put in place in the years to come, and that he's going to be there for quite a number of years, is quite troubling, especially given that we are so close to an election in Alberta. It almost seems like the NDP are trying to just make it harder for the UCP to actually do what most Albertans want them to do on the issue. And they could not have picked someone who is more adverse to Alberta energy than they have in Ed Whittingham. And it's completely amazing that the media has not covered this before now.
I think the only bigger red flag that you could possibly get is hiring someone from the Suzuki Foundation.
Yeah, or even someone from the U.S. to do it.
Yeah, as we mentioned in our Google story. So there's lots of questions here, and you know the media should be covering this because I think Albertans deserve to know who is going to be making decisions. And this is an appointment; it's an unelected body. And you know, looking into the contracts that are set up, it's not easy to terminate contracts once you sign someone to this. So we're going to have a lot of questions here going forward on this. So.
That's for sure.
All right, I think it's time to get caught up with the SNC-Lavalin story. So what do we got on that this week?
Yes, we're going to return to the ongoing issue, the SNC corruption scandal, which has been rocking federal politics and shaking Trudeau's federal government. Currently, his ship is taking on water and in risk of capsizing. And just this week, one of his top cabinet ministers has metaphorically taken off with one of the lifeboats. Now, for those needing a recap on the issue, have a look at last week's episode, where we detailed former Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould's damning testimony alleging that she received veiled threats from members of Trudeau's PMO to let SNC off the hook in a corruption trial so that Trudeau could cater more to Quebec. Now, ever since Wilson-Raybould's testimony, Trudeau has faced calls to resign. We also talked about the testimony of Gerald Butts, the now-resigned principal secretary of Justin Trudeau, who testified that he said, quote, "There's no solution here that doesn't require some interference." But let's get back to the cabinet minister who jumped ship. Jane Philpott, who is the former Treasury Board president, was highly respected in her position and widely known as one of Trudeau's most competent ministers. In a statement posted to her MP website, Philpott said that the recent events, including the SNC-Lavalin scandal, quote, "have shaken the federal government in recent weeks, and after serious reflection, I've concluded that I must resign as a member of cabinet." Now, in her resignation letter, Philpott cites the convention of cabinet solidarity, where ministers must always be prepared to defend other ministers publicly, in saying that it had become untenable to continue to serve in cabinet. Philpott also said that the evidence of alleged pressure offered by her friend and former fellow minister Wilson Raybould has raised serious concerns for her. She said, quote, "The solemn principles at stake are the independence and integrity of our justice system. Sadly, I have lost confidence in how the government has dealt with this matter and in how it has responded to the issues raised." Philpott said this in her resignation letter to Trudeau. Now, the independence and integrity of the justice system is also important to the Public Prosecution Service of Canada, a governmental body set up shortly after Stephen Harper became minister. As we said last week, back in 2006, one of the first bills passed by the government of Harper was the Director of Public Prosecutions Act. Now, this act was designed to prevent future occurrences of the sponsorship scandal that saw government money funneled to liberal advertising in Quebec. Now, this act prevented the government from overruling the Director of Public Prosecutions created by this act in 2006. Now, if the government were to overrule the director, they would have to announce this publicly. This week, the Public Prosecution Service of Canada tweeted that, quote, "Prosecutorial independence is key to our mandate. Our prosecutors must be objective, independent, and dispassionate, as well as free from improper influence, including political influence." That means no PMO influence and certainly no influence on Trudeau. Now, Public Services and Procurement and Accessibility Minister Carla Qualtro is assuming Philpott's portfolio in an acting capacity. It's yet to be seen if this will prompt the third cabinet shuffle in as many months, or whether a sole person will be named to that role. Treasury Board President is a role typically held by a more senior minister. In a press conference, Conservative leader Andrew Scheer said that Philpott's resignation clearly demonstrates a government in total chaos led by a disgraced prime minister. He made a direct call to other Liberal cabinet ministers to think about following suit, saying that the remaining cabinet ministers either need to force Trudeau to stand down or to dissociate themselves from the scandal. He said, quote, "Is this what you got into politics for? If not, it's time for them to stand up and be heard, like Jane Philpott did today." NDP leader Jagmeet Singh said in a tweet that Philpott's resignation, quote, "now more than ever compels the need for a public inquiry." He said it raises serious questions about the alleged interference of Trudeau's government and its commitment to reconciliation. The NDP are calling for Trudeau to testify under oath about the whole scandal. Singh said this in a statement, quote, "Jane Philpott has made her decision based on information she received from cabinet. Canadians deserve to know what happened as well." Now, reacting to the sudden resignation, fellow Liberal MP Selena Cesar-Chavan also announced that this weekend that she won't be running again for the Liberals in 2019. A second Liberal MP, Wayne Long, has also spoken out, not for the first time for him on this case, to say that Philpott's resignation further bolsters the argument that an independent investigation is needed. Long said this in a statement, quote, "I am deeply troubled by the fact that Ms. Philpott felt the need to resign as a result of our government's handling of this matter. I believe we will not be able to successfully return our focus to this work until they have those answers." Now, on CTV's Power Play segment, Soma Strategies Vice President Kate Harrison said that ahead of the previous election in 2015, the Liberal Party recruited a number of established professionals who were not partisans on the promise to do politics in a less partisan way, and noted that Wilson Raybould and Philpott were two of those star candidates. Harrison that Phil said that Philpott's resignation is the result of not delivering on that promise. Now, as for Justin Trudeau, he deflected concerns about misconduct and enabling of corruption in the PMO, while similarly trying to throw Wilson-Raybould under the bus on the issue by trying to boil down the whole scandal to a simple erosion of trust. At a news conference on Thursday in Ottawa, Trudeau said that he tasked his staff members to engage Wilson-Raybould on the file while she was Justice Minister to stress the potential impact of her decision. In hindsight, he said, he should have reached out personally on the crucial matter instead of dispatching staff. Now, he said that an erosion of trust developed between his principal secretary at the time, Gerald Butts, and Wilson-Raybould. He said, quote, I was not aware of that erosion of trust, and as Prime Minister and leader of the federal ministry, I should have been. Now, when he was asked in the news conference if he was, quote, specifically apologizing for anything today, referring to the SNC scandal, he said, I will actually be making an Inuit apology this afternoon, referring to his trip to Iqaluit to apologize for the way that the federal government handled tuberculosis outbreaks in the North in the mid-20th century. As John Iveson of the National Post writes, quote, it'll be an opportunity for more images of the kind in which Trudeau and his spin doctors have specialized over the past 3 years, a chance to highlight his compassion, empathy, and sensitivity, while apologizing for historic wrongs that he personally had nothing to do with. Yet when it comes to accounting for his own mistakes, he is less demonstrative. His advisors have previously suggested that his appearance to answer questions on SNC would involve a display of contrition. Now, while acknowledging that he could have acted differently as events of SNC unfolded, Trudeau stopped short of apologizing for the interactions he and other senior officials had with the former Attorney General about the Quebec engineering case. Now, he said, quote, each of these interactions was a conversation among colleagues about how to tackle the challenging issue. Each came at a time when my staff and I believed that the former Attorney General was open to considering other aspects of the public interest. However, I now understand that she saw it differently. Now, these last words invoke his words talking about the groping scandal last summer, where he was alleged to have inappropriately touched a female reporter 18 years ago. At the time, he said, quote, there's a lot of uncertainties around this. In my terms of my recollection, there was no untoward or inappropriate action, but she was in a professional context. Who knows where her mind was, and I fully respect her ability to experience something differently. So, do those two statements sound familiar? Other than apologizing or making amends, he tried to discredit the woman, just as he has been doing now with Wilson-Raybould. I guess the self-proclaimed feminist prime minister just experienced feminism differently than women do. Unfortunately for him, one can't experience the truth differently. It is the truth. Perhaps we need a prime minister that will tell it.
And, you know, when it comes down to all these stories in regards to truth, we saw during the week where Jody Wilson-Raybould was testifying that even in the media, there were headlines, Jody Wilson-Raybould speaks her truth. And when you look at it that way, the media is in effect enabling what Trudeau said this week in that people experience things differently, when in reality we know that when you are coming from a pure legal mindset, there is indeed only one truth, and that truth is governed by the law, and that's what most of the country indeed should be governed for. And, you know, I think we also have to look back to what you said about the Inuit apology on this. When he was asked about if he was going to be making an apology that day, it was quite clear to him and to everybody in the room that he was there to speak about SNC. And the very fact he brought up the Inuit apology when he was talking about SNC just shows how out of touch he is in regards to what the general populace feels about this issue. Because you schedule a press conference at 8 a.m. to talk about the SNC story. Someone asks you if you're going to be making an apology. They can look at the Prime Minister's itinerary to see that he was going to be going to Inuvik, or was supposed to go to Inuvik at least that day. The weather called it off to make that apology. But the very fact it was a distortion to the Inuit apology rather than something about SNC speaks volumes.
Yeah, and it exactly shows that the government, and Trudeau in particular, is just trying to sweep all this under the carpet and to try and turn the page and get the media talking about something else. They're trying to get them to talk about him being contrite about the Inuit, things that happened a half a century ago regarding the federal government, and something that he didn't do personally. Instead, the media is still talking about this issue, still uncovering details, and every week we're finding new information about this. And Trudeau's trying to make light of it, and he's trying to sweep it under the rug and tell the media that Wilson Raybould just experienced things differently. Well, as I said, it's the truth, and you can't experience truth differently when it comes to something legal like this. There is the way things happened, and clearly, he doesn't seem to understand that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one angle missed heavily by the media this week, the mainstream media, is that we have the Public Prosecution of Service of Canada, which was created in 2006 in order to try and also prevent the sponsorship scandal and things like it from happening. The very fact that they needed to issue a tweet saying prosecutorial independence is key to our mandate, our prosecutors must be objective, independent, dispassionate, as well as free as improper influence, including political influence, speaks volumes. When in the past would we have had a public prosecution service in a country like Canada? I have to say that.
Yeah, it does speak volumes in the fact that there, you know, when you read between the lines, given that they're a government agency, you're finding out that they are feeling like this should be addressed and that there should be no political influence in this. And if you kind of read into it, that pretty much means that it did happen and that there was political influence on this issue and that there was smoke there and that the smoke indicates that there is a fire, of course.
And, you know, you mentioned smoke where there's fire, but, you know, this also speaks to a extra work that should have been done by both Jagmeet Singh and Andrew Scheer this week, in that, you know, there were plenty of opportunities here for both of them to say that they would get rid of this provision in the law for removing these deferred prosecution agreements. To my knowledge, neither of them have said that. And, you know, social media is powerful. They do have the power to rally people against the prime minister, against the government on this. And Andrew Scheer was asked if he was going to be tabling a motion of non-confidence in the House. He said no. And, you know, you can see why. That obviously wouldn't pass. But there is also the forum, the public forum online, and having folks write letters and call their MPs about this, expressing their displeasure. Both Jagmeet Singh and Andrew Scheer could have done something to that effect in order to highlight the fire from the smoke, but they didn't do that. So that's a missed opportunity on their part too.
Yeah, exactly. Especially as we're heading into a federal election later this year, it seems like Trudeau is already trying to campaign. He's moving around the country trying to drum up support. It's not really working for him, I don't think, but it's pretty clear that Andrew Scheer and Jagmeet Singh, should they want to actually be prime minister at some point, they should be doing this same sort of thing, and they're supposed to be working on our behalf to make sure that the government is held to account. And while Scheer has been calling for Trudeau to resign, it's pretty clear that he's not going to at this point. So he has to explore other avenues to make sure that the government is held to account.
Indeed. All right. Well, I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week. And surprisingly, we haven't done this one before.
Yeah, it is pretty surprising. Our word of the week this week is transparency. Now, this is defined as operating in such a way that it is easy for others to see what actions are being performed, implying openness, communication, and accountability. Now, I think transparency this week can definitely apply to the SNC case, where there should have been a lot more transparency on the issue than there actually was, and that the government is still trying to hide and to not let Wilson Raybould speak completely clearly on this issue. And I think transparency can also apply to the Alberta story, where the media was trying to sweep this story under the rug, and they were trying to not cover it just because the Rebel covered it first, and that we need to know exactly who's going to be in charge of our energy regulators to approve these projects going forward. And I think transparency can also be in place in the other two stories too, talking about the Google ads and the fact that Google has been very transparent as to the reasons why they aren't going to be running political ads.
Yeah, and that speaks to ultimately a problem with the legislation, and that the folks who drafted it weren't really fully well-versed on how Google works as a company, or at least the ad side of it. So,
And I think that's why transparency is our word of the week this week.
And if you want full show notes to read into all the supplementary sources for this episode, you can find that at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the show on any number of podcast listeners out there, iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, all of that and more. You can find at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where we share these stories and more throughout the entire week. You can find us on both of those social media sharing websites at Western Context. And with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll make sure to always look through all the stories that the media is and isn't talking about during the week to make sure that we have the full context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. With that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.